I didn't have exposure to other people that were expressing themselves that way. So even though my family was doing everything in their power within their own reasonable understanding
of absolutely
what was acceptable, they were trying to give me some freedom to be myself. Mm-hmm. I still was consumed with shame because of everything else, the entire world that I was aware of at the time.
Well, because when your world is that small, you think, yeah, I'm the only one.
Yeah. Welcome back to Dear Polly, a podcast about sexual exploration and polyamory. I am so excited to introduce Rebecca Miner from genderspecialist.com. I feel like this is a perfect follow-up to our last episode, but also looks forward to the future. Rebecca works with youth on gender and sexuality issues, but also has a lot of exposure to their relationship dynamics. In this episode, we discuss the entire spectrum. It's packed with really incredible conversation, and I struggled to cut it down. So I didn't. I cut it in two. What better way to see the future than to look into the youth of today? If there is a topic or a question you would like us to cover, please reach out via our website at DearPollyPodcast.com or on the gram at DearPollyPodcast. Make sure to follow us, like and share, but most importantly, I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Dear Polly.
Thank you.
Really, really glad that you agreed to come on. And it's so interesting because I feel like the timing is perfect for it. I've been on this kind of journey of self-discovery for roughly 2 years now. And I've just, I've just shaken my whole foundation. Like everything that I thought I knew, I challenged that. I've read, listened to, watched everything that I could to expand my understanding of what is versus what's expected. And mm-hmm.
You mean in terms of like a mononormative society?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So like all of it, like mm-hmm. Relationships, gender identity, like just everything. And
the whole thing.
it started with relationships. And it's interesting. I'm not really sure where gender became a part of that conversation, that education, mm-hmm. but somewhere along the way it did. And a friend of mine, as I was telling a friend of mine that this has come up in kind of that exploration, and it made me start really thinking about my past and mm-hmm. my own personal journey with gender identity. I don't know if you've listened to my intro interview for my podcast, but
I should have.
In my in my early 20s, I actually thought I was trans. And
oh, okay.
I started the process. I joined a group therapy that was offered in my community and even started hormones. And when my body started to change at about like 8 to 12 months in, mm-hmm. it really shook me. And I was like, I put the brakes on it. And I was like, I don't think I want to change my body as like mm-hmm. the reality of that was setting in. So stop the hormones. But in my brain, my understanding was if I'm not going to change my body, then I couldn't embrace my femininity.
Yes. Yes. Right. Because we have such limited ideas around what those constructs look like.
Yeah.
And especially when it comes to like, I think societally, we don't allow for a lot of fluidity for folks who are assigned male at birth in the same way that we do for folks who are assigned female.
Yes.
Yes.
There's no recognition or like public acceptance of a spectrum between masculine and feminine.
No, and we're missing a public discourse around that for mm-hmm. sure, right? Because I can wear a tie and people are like, oh, that's cute. And it, yeah. you know, it might be visibly queer and that's fun. But if you wear a skirt, it's a different story.
Women can wear a power suit and it is empowering.
I love a power suit. Yeah.
Men can't wear a sexy dress and be seen as empowering.
Right. Right.
I say that very blanket.
In fact, it comes with a whole lot of risk.
It does. It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Sure. Of course, it could be seen as empowering in certain spaces. And we love that.
But not.
But the reality is on a day-to-day.
Yeah. It's not the same way that it is with a woman in a power suit. It's not the same way. Because a woman in a power suit that can be incredibly feminine can walk into a professional meeting and it's like she gets jaw-dropping respect for how she pulls
Absolutely.
It off. But a man can't be masculine in presentation or mannerisms and wear a stunning dress to, you know, a special event and get the same type of like just automatic respect for how well they pull it off. It just doesn't, mm-hmm. it's not the same.
Yeah. And it raises the question of like, what does masculine presentation even mean?
Oh, 100%. 100%. This right? is going to be a great conversation. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited.
So, not my last episode. Wait, was it my last episode? No, wait, was it? Oh my gosh. So I took a cycle off. I do one every 2 weeks and I took a cycle off because it was my birthday and I was turning 40.
Happy birthday. Thanks. Okay, 40.
So it was kind of a big deal. And I was like, I'm not going to deal with social media. I'm not going to worry about trying to put out a podcast. I'm like, I'm going to take a couple weeks to just enjoy this, you know, kind of pivotal moment in my life.
Good for you. Yeah, you made it.
I just did a whole like post on my personal Facebook and personal Instagram, like letting people kind of get caught up on this journey that I've had hidden. I put myself out as publicly poly. I put myself out as publicly non-binary. And
congratulations. That's a huge thing to put out into the world.
Yeah. So
bold steps.
Yeah. So I, you know, took a little time to myself. But
how's it been received?
Incredibly positive. And I come from a small town in Midwest Missouri. So I was sure.
So this was a big step. Yeah.
Not sure how it was going to go over, but it's gone over really, really well. Now, my family has been really quiet on it.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. my family was the biggest thing I was worried about.
As it so often is, right?
Just really putting all of that out there. And my immediate family, like my dad, it was not aware yet of my non-binary
ness.
Yes.
He, identity.
Right. He was aware of the poly status though, because that evolved out of my last relationship kind of coming to a close.
Gotcha.
And he was super cool about that. His response was basically like, well, I'm glad you're trying new things. Yeah. You know? So
great.
But my extended family, though, from Louisiana, even more conservative, we'll see what happens there. No words so far on the horizon, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. Okay. Well, I hope you have some solid support from chosen family as well.
I've got incredible support from my chosen family. Absolutely. Good. It's what really empowered me to feel like I could go public with it, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty bold of you to even have the podcast without being publicly out.
Well, I feel like, I mean, my podcast isn't huge yet. So I say yet because I want to think optimistically.
Of course.
And I don't know how many of my extended family even listens to podcasts. So I wasn't really
Fair
worried
enough.
That anybody was going to stumble upon it. I mean, and if they did, it would probably be like, I don't know, some very conservative talk radio host. So they wouldn't stumble into my genre.
Right.
But my last episode was actually with, Barry Brandon, the Queer Indigo on Instagram and TikTok. And we talked about, you know, life, love, and sex off the binary. So,
yes, so good. So
this
important.
Is like perfect timing. And I'm a huge fan of your content, and I didn't realize that you focused on like youth. And I'm super interested in having a conversation with what it is that you're seeing right now with youth, because I have this big curiosity around how technology is or could be impacting Journey for Youth, because, you know, I'm turning 40 and just now exploring who I really am.
Yes.
And a lot of that is the result of visibility through social media. So before I get too much, I'm sorry. I'm a talker and really excited about this.
You don't need to be sorry.
Topic. I want to give you
an
opportunity.
I'm thrilled to be here.
To introduce yourself.
Oh, sure. So my name is Rebecca Miner. I use she, her pronouns. I am a gender specialist. So I work primarily with trans and gender nonconforming youth as an individual and group therapist, and then also as a guide to their parents in affirming it. So it's a little mix of both worlds. I do have some adult clients, but the bulk of my work is focused on working with young people.
That is absolutely incredible. And I love that you couple work with the teens and the youth with the parents, because I feel like that's really important.
Well, and I realized that's what was missing from my work, right? I'd been doing this clinical work for years now, working like strictly focused on the young people. And I had some interaction with parents. Of course, there are parents who, you know, have a lot of questions and concerns and want to talk. And, you know, I realized I have this professor in grad school who I recently heard that this is actually part of a larger fable. But there's a story about someone in a village where they kept having all of these babies in the river, like they were finding infants in a river. And so there were people day after day pulling these babies out of the river. And finally, someone thought, I'm going to go upstream and figure out why all these babies are even in the river in the first place. And I realized I've been in the river and I can stay here and I'm good at it and I like doing it and I'm helping each baby along the way. But the reality is, to affect greater change, we've got to go upstream. And so it's really the parents, right, that are where the bulk of this work is. Because I find the more I educate parents, the more they're able to show up for their kids in the ways that they really want to, but are afraid of and don't have the right information to.
I absolutely love that. What a beautiful little analogy too, of like pulling that all together, that awakening.
Yeah, I need to find the original story. But yeah, she was like, you can either be, I realized I didn't complete my thought. My professor was like, you can either be the kind of social worker who's in the river, or you can be the one that goes upstream. And so here I am trying to do it all.
I absolutely love it. I love it. Okay. So I have some, I did take some little notes, some thoughts that I want to cover. And then of course I started making a to-do list for today. So now I have to get back to the right page. Sorry. I can be a little all over the place.
Oh, you and me both. So good luck to us and all those listening.
Fingers crossed. Okay. So I just want to also like put a little shout out. Your website is genderspecialist.com, correct?
Yes.
I don't know if we said that yet. Perfect. We've had your introduction. Now, what age groups, in terms of like with the youth, what age groups do you primarily work with, if that's an okay question to ask?
Of course, of course. I don't see anyone under the age of 12 typically. So most of my clients are in high school and college.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great ages. God, high school.
Yeah. Some of middle school, right? Those last couple of years of middle school, which are so rough, you know, trans or not. And then you add the gender piece and it's a whole other, you know, circus.
I can tell you, I have people that were great friends of mine in my like fifth grade to high school years. And I can not even remember their last name, but I can picture their face. I know their first name. I have great memories with them. From fifth grade to seventh grade, there were three boys that terrorized me. I remember their first and last names, and I don't know that I will ever forget their names. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's how trauma works.
Yeah. And this is so many years later, and I have never seen them again, but I will never forget their names. I can even tell you where they live. Well, they did as kids.
I was going to say, should we out them on the podcast so people can go, no. I'm kidding.
Well, I lived out in the country, and it was like an hour and a half long bus ride because all the homes are like just spread around out in the country.
Whoa.
And yeah. I think I was like number, we were early on in the bus ride. So we were probably like the fifth house to get picked up. And so, and everybody rode the bus out in the country. It wasn't a matter of like being cool or not. Everybody rode the bus. It's just how you got to school. And so I remember where their houses are on that hour and a half long trek through the countryside. So
It's amazing what we hold on to, right? You're like, I don't know where my keys are, but I remember my bully's first and last names and home locations.
It's wild. It's wild.
Yeah.
So with this age group that you're working with, what is like entailed in the work that you do? I know that's a vague question, but like to kind of get some perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously it depends on the client, right? Everybody's care is individualized, as I think it should be. But a lot of what I do is spending time kind of unpacking the ideas that my clients have been socialized to believe around gender and sexuality, and then helping them get clear around what is actually at the root of their identity. And then how to communicate that to the people in their lives. If there are changes they want to make, how to go about those. So for some of my clients who do a more social or medical transition, I help with that process. I also do letter writing. I realized I never mentioned that, but I should. I'm part of a really cool organization of clinicians that have signed, oh my goodness, what's the word? Not petition, but like when you all agree to something.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the word.
We're all part of a directory of therapists who are willing to write free and reduced letters for people who are trying to access gender-affirming surgery.
That's
because
incredible.
That's such a barrier to access, right? And so so that's one of the things that I do for my clients and other folks who I don't see as consistently. So I do that. I'm trying to think. I mean, I talk about relationships, you know, everything that comes up in life in addition to the intersection of trauma, gender, and sexuality.
Okay. I have so many questions.
I got time.
I'm so sorry. I had three thoughts come up, three separate questions, that I want to approach with this. And I knew that if I asked one immediately, I'd forget the other two before I got them written down. So I wanted to write all three down because I don't
relate to
lose any of these
deeply.
I'm very, very excited. Okay. So which one do I want to ask first? Okay. Since we're already right here, I'm going to say, when you talk about how you're like uncovering kind of the obstacles that they're facing in finding themselves, so to speak, what do you find is the most common like theme or hurdle that you have to help them work through?
That's a really good question. I think the worst of it is letting go of all of the kind of stereotypes around gender and coming to the understanding that they can be male, female, non-binary, any other term you want to choose under the sun, and that can look whatever way they want that to look. And that, you know, presentation does not equal identity. That's a huge one. Is like, I have so many clients who, you know, want to change their pronouns or want to move forward with the transition, and they feel like they can't because they can't ask that of the people in their lives yet when they aren't physically presenting themselves as what they think they should look like.
Wow. I could definitely see where that would be a massive hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
But also incredibly freeing to come to that realization.
Yes, yes. And like we were talking about earlier, it's that hurdle is far more challenging for my clients who've been assigned male at birth. For a lot of my clients who've been assigned female at birth, they've maybe come out to their parents as a lesbian already. They've been identified as a tomboy most of their lives. And that's not always the case, right? I'm just giving examples, but, right. You know, there's more flexibility there and room to explore and play. And so that often doesn't come as much of a surprise as, right, like the parent phone calls I get from clients who've been assigned male at birth and who've really barely let their parents in on this at all. Oftentimes those parents are the most shocked and concerned that this is not reality, that this is a phase, that this is, you know, something that they learned from their friends or something they heard about on the TikTok, you know, and so I could go on and on and on about that, but you're lighting up. So I feel like you have another question.
I do. So you made a comment there that, I want to explore as a question. And it's interesting because it ties directly to a comment that was put on my Facebook, in regard to kind of my, like, my coming out, if you will. Mm-hmm. One of the individuals from my past, provided tons of like supportive praise for my coming out, but also, made note of some posts that they had made on their Facebook around youth that are facing, gender identity issues, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they did not want me to like confuse the post that they had made with like they're not being supportive of my own exploration. And so I had not seen the post on Facebook. So I went back and I checked them out. And the posts were in reference to not overly encouraging the exploration of their gender at too young of an age, because it could be a phase. And
right.
It was in reference to an article that was saying that, it only showed a snippet of the article. It wasn't a link to the article, so I don't really know like the full context, but it was saying something about how, like between 10 and 12 is when kids will start to gravitate towards the things that they will associate with or that they will identify with as their gender identity. And there was
That's
like
way too late.
There were, well, and so I don't know. And then there was like a follow-up. The thing was like a caption and then like a post of somebody's response to that. And so they just got this little snapshot. So I don't know a lot of context, but the post response to that that was in this image was a mother saying, "I was a tomboy as a child, but I'm an incredibly feminine heterosexual woman now. So you shouldn't put too much focus on that." So my question is like, how do you handle that? What do you look for? How do you know if it's a phase versus like an exploration of my actual identity? And I've always been an advocate for like starting a transition as young as possible for someone that's trans. So that, and this may be my own skewed perception of what might be important to a young trans person, but like passability, if you start younger, is so much more successful. And I mean, according to what standards, but I mean.
Well, according to safety. Right. There is some reality to that. Right. Yeah. So the whole concept of passing is really messy and loaded.
I know.
And I totally respect like you treading lightly around the subject. But there is a reality to the fact that, you know, I have clients who won't even have to have top surgery because we started them on blockers and then testosterone. And now they look just like all the other boys they go to school with. And will never have to be outed at a public pool or a beach or a birthday party, right? This is, so, you know, he's going to be able to move through the world with the same ease as his cisgender peers.
That gave me goosebumps. goosebumps like that.
Yeah. And that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I'm like, this is actually life-saving healthcare, right? Like puberty blockers are life-saving medicine. And so I recently wrote an article, in Insider about this very question, which is like, are they, you know, how old is, or how young is too young to know? And the research really shows that kids are starting to develop their gender identity as early as 3. And yes, I know. And it shocks people. It makes people very uncomfortable. Of course, that development continues over time, but a lot of 3-year-olds are able to identify themselves. Now, is that identification because so many people have said, oh, you're a little boy or you're a little girl? You know, people have questions about that. But regardless of trans or cisgender identity, the data remains the same, that the gender development process and age timeline is the same. So we really need to listen to young kids. And so often I sit with clients who, I mean, they're still pretty young, right? I mean, there are going to be people who listen to this that are like, I'm in my 50s and no one ever talked to me like that. I wish I'd known that. I have teen clients who are like, I wish my teacher had listened to me, or I wish my mom had listened to me when I said outright, I am a girl, or like, I don't want to wear that. And so when people ask, like, how do you know it's a phase? I mean, first of all, pretending to be trans is not fun. You don't get a lot of benefits. Like no one's throwing you a party. Like it's not something that you're like, ooh, that sounds like a fun thing to try on. It's a huge endeavor that, you know, can disrupt a lot of areas of your life. So this is not something that people are just like doing on a whim. And then in addition to that, like when we see, and so there's a phrase of like, looking for kind of persistent and consistent statements around gender. And that's not always true, right? And that's what's so tricky about gender is there are some kids who don't demonstrate any difference until the onset of puberty. And they're like, whoa, what is happening to my body? This is totally foreign to me and I'm freaking out. And then there are kids who from the age of 3 have very clearly been able to say, this is me, this is who I am. And so my thought is, if they know who they are, we should listen to them. And God forbid it's a phase, then maybe they wore a dress for a little while at home and it didn't hurt anybody because they're 4 years old, but it let them explore. right? Rather than teaching them that it's wrong to feel that way or it's wrong to think that. I have people in my life who have shared with, and I love hearing these stories of like cisgender men who went through phases of loving dress up as a kid and like maybe even wore a dress to kindergarten or something because their parents were exceptionally cool for the 90s. and then just stopped, right? Like that just wasn't a thing and then kept on going with their lives. But if their parents had made a huge deal out of it and been like, no, we're going to punish you for that, or you can't do that, then, you know, we know what that does. Kids are going to do it anyway, but they're going to do it with a lot of shame and self-hatred. And so why would we do that to kids? Yeah. That was a long rambling answer.
No, it was a great answer.
I have so much to say about this.
It's a great answer. I think that you're right.
I mean, like, me too.
like my weighing in on that finalizes it. But I, you know, as a kid, it's so funny because our parents would give us a weekly allowance and we would go to the toy store and we would each pick out our toy. And, you know, my brothers both went to like Legos, G.I. Joes, Star Wars figurines, like things like that, that could battle, you know, and mine was My Little Ponies. I had a thing for My Little Ponies. And then My Little Ponies turned into Treasure Trolls because those were like trendy.
Of course. Yes.
And I could do their hair. I would do the Treasure Trolls hair.
Well, they had the best hair.
They did. And then I vividly remember this because my brothers actually picked on me for this one. But there's also.
So you were allowed to purchase those, just so I understand. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
My dad was uncomfortable, and I only know this from conversations with them both, but my dad was uncomfortable with it initially, but my mother was insistent that I be allowed to explore what I'm interested in. And she was like, it's a My Little Pony. It's not like he's taking home a dress, you know, he's playing with a toy. So mom would take me to the My Little Pony aisle, and my dad would take my brothers to the G.I. Joe aisle. But we went to a rodeo as a kid. And we went to probably a lot of rodeos as a kid. I mean, I grew up in the sticks. Like, quite literally, my high school had 8 rooms in it. 8 total rooms.
Oh, my goodness.
I was a junior high and a high school. My graduating class would have been 36.
That's like a single classroom.
Two classes. They would pull the divider down the middle and they would teach 2 classes because there weren't enough rooms. Yeah. So it's crazy. Hillbilly. Okay. That's why it was an hour and a half long bus ride. But so we went to this rodeo and we were each allowed to buy a cowboy hat. And I picked out the purple and white ombre one that was covered in purple and white.
Yes, you did.
Feathers.
Oh.
And I wore that thing so proudly. It's in a ton of pictures from my childhood for a few years. So,
I'm so glad. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you loved that hat.
I loved that hat.
Yeah. So see what happens when we let kids just like explore a little, try things on. Right? Yeah. It didn't have to turn into a big fight.
It didn't. I do wish that I don't know what I wish. I wish that coupled with those experiences, I'd had the visibility that technology now provides.
Absolutely.
To know that there were others in the world doing that, because living in a hillbilly community, I didn't have exposure to other people that were expressing themselves that way. So even though my family was doing everything in their power within their own reasonable understanding of what was acceptable, they were trying to give me some freedom to be myself. I still was consumed with shame because of everything else, the entire world that I was aware of at the time.
Well, because when your world is that small, you think I'm the only one.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why I run groups for young people too, because they're often, and this has changed, even in the span of the time that I've been in practice, it's changed that now they have, you know, they have trans friends, they have queer friends at school. It cracks me up because I'll ask them sometimes like, oh, do you go to the GSA at school? And they're like, no, why would I even do that? And I'm like, to meet other queer people. And they're like, why? But all my friends are gay. They're like, that club's for the angry gays, which is hilarious to me because I'm like, oh, you mean people who are like advocating for change? But like when I was in high school, there were only like a couple people who were out, and the rest of us, including myself, were allies. And like, I just can't even wrap my head around it.
Sometimes I can't wrap my head around that.
At all.
I was the first. So after seventh grade, after ninth grade, we moved for 10th grade to the city, Springfield, Missouri, I went from a graduating class of like 36 to 300 and something.
That's a big shift though.
Yeah. It was a big shift. My dad wanted us to get a better education in that dual classroom. Shit.
Also for anyone neurodivergent, you could never focus in that space.
No. So he moved us to the city, and there was enough diversity in that school that I was feeling more empowered to express myself. And as I explored that, I came out, I guess, the later end of that year, because I got a girlfriend for a minute. And and then which was totally cool until she actually wanted to do something physical. And the first time she kissed me, I was like, whoa, is not right. And then I came out of the closet like 24 hours later. I was the first gay person to come out while in school. There had been two gay people that came out after they had graduated.
After high school. So then it was just like the rumors got around.
Yes.
Right.
But I was the first one to come out publicly while in school.
And you blazing the trail.
Doing what I can. And it was interesting because I almost overnight went from being picked on for being gay to being cool because I was gay.
Interesting.
It was like, I was like the cool girl's accessory now.
Oh, well, yes, that's absolutely true. Yeah. Yeah.
I was doing everybody's hair for prom, like all of that kind of stuff. Oh! We didn't have a gay straight alliance. And it was after I graduated that my school, even though it was the one on the north side of town, which is kind of country bumpkin in and of itself and not as like progressive as the other schools, it was the first school in Springfield, Missouri to have a gay straight alliance after I left. So, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Making change.
I just thought it was really cool because I never thought my school would do that, or let alone.
Yeah,
be the
I mean,
first
what
in that
what's
city.
Roughly the timeline we're talking about here?
2001.
Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.